next up, to take us into a more, slightly more technological bent, we have Tim Fabrizio, who most of you will know, who has been researching and writing about the talking machine for 42 years. He has lectured, demonstrated, and participated in seminars in foreign countries, arts conferences, meetings of various phonograph collecting groups, and other organizations. Has consulted for the Library of Congress, the International Museum of Photography, and other archives and museums. He's authored a series of 8 books on the history of recorded sound in collaboration with George Paul. Recently, he made an appearance as an expert on the PBS TV show The History Detectives. So, Tim.
Get this guy. Okay. All right. No, I got it. Cool.
You got that. Okay. Do you want me to hit the play button?
There. No. I think. Well.
Okay. I think that right there puts it on full screen. I'm looking right there. Do you want it on full screen?
Yeah. Please.
Okay. There we go.
Okay. And this thing is working. All right. I decided that. By the way, thank you very much. I'm here all week. Please visit our food court. I decided my original title was not coy enough, so I kind of coyed it up a little bit with flower. And then that wasn't coy enough, so I made an even coyer subtitle. Anyway.
Not cream ale.
A 134 years ago, almost to the day, May 20th, 1878, starting at 10 a.m., Edison's phonograph was exhibited in Rochester. We can imagine a fine spring day, rather like today, as the curious denizens of the Flower City ascended the stairs to the top floor of the recently completed Mackey Music Company on State Street. There, in a hall rented by exhibitor J.S. Vale, Edison's greatest invention, as the handbill touted, the speaking phonograph, or talking machine, was demonstrated. Less than a month had passed since the Edison Speaking Phonograph Company had been officially organized by a group of ambitious businessmen, though it has been functioning informally for several months. J.S. Vale had acquired phonograph serial number 4 for $95.50 and had set out to canvass New York State. A few weeks following his Rochester visit on June 8th, he would be presenting in nearby Dansville. However, the event announced on the flyer you see here was not the phonograph's debut on the banks of the Genesee. On March 12, 1878, a gala presentation was held at Corinthian Hall, which we've learned about, Rochester's foremost concert venue, which dwarfed Mr. Vale's efforts by comparison. Yet, the character of both of these appearances was very much rooted in the invention's own limitations. Practical and enduring qualities were to evade Edison's phonograph for more than a decade following its invention in December of 1877. Evident from the first, however, was the device's pop appeal, perfect for a quasi-scientific exhibition. One of the phonograph's early boosters was Edward H. Johnson, a one-time telegrapher and associate of Edison, who had been traveling during 1877, demonstrating Edison's version of the telephone. Even before the working prototype of the phonograph was ready on December 6, 1877, E.A. Johnson was sniffing around and had caught a whiff of the publicity potential of Edison's putative recording device. After the phonograph was successfully exhibited at the offices of the Scientific American on December 7th, Johnson joined forces with another born promoter, journalist Uriah Hunt Painter, and an investor group soon was assembled, which contracted with Edison to arrange the manufacture and distribution of his apparatus. With Johnson as the idea man, the Edison-speaking phonograph company was inaugurated on the premise that the machines would be offered for exhibition purposes to showmen who would maintain a defined territory. Although practically everything having to do with the speaking phonograph company would be rather quickly compromised, changed, and corrupted, the initial attraction was to men like Johnson himself. A correspondence visit to the Manhattan office of Edward A. Johnson reported in the New York World on March 12, 1878, though having occurred somewhat earlier, suggests what could be expected from a phonograph exhibition. Two gentlemen were sitting, whirling around a couple of cranks attached to a pair of grooved brass cylinders, and shouting with every appearance of gravity and mature decorum, but with exceeding lustiness, "Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow." Mr. Johnson was the first to finish the tale of Mary, and with a final quick turn of the crank, he bawled cock-a-doodle-doo in stentorian tones into the funnel, and then turned with swollen veins and bloodshot eyes and welcomed the reporter to be witness to the strange workings of Mr. Edison's phonograph. This account is typical. Phonographic demonstrations did not involve very sophisticated fare. A mere recitation of simple rhymes and well-known Shakespearean quotes was sufficient to obtain an astonished response from the audience. In fact, no one was better suited to bringing the phonograph to Rochester than Edward A. Johnson himself. During the development of the speaking phonograph company, he resumed his peregrinations, showcasing Edison's telephone. A typical telephonic demonstration would assume the complexion of one reported by the Buffalo Courier of February 6, 1878. Mr. Johnson, the telephone concert man, gave some music last evening at Jamestown, New York, for the benefit of an audience in Meadville, PA. The instruments used were the Edison telephone and a wire belonging to the Western Union Telegraph Company. Those who got hold of them held the small bell handles of the speaking telephone to their ears. The tunes came thick and fast, the different voices of the singers being easily distinguished from one another. Yet, Johnson had a special treat reserved for the neighbor cities of Buffalo and Rochester, where on March 12th, he gave what the Rochester Daily Union and Advisor dubbed a soiree téléphonique. The newspaper reported in its March 13th issue, "The first part of the exhibition consisted of a concert, the singers and instrumentalists being in Buffalo. The singing of Mr. E.H. Arnold and Miss Annie L. Hodges individually was very plainly heard from Edison's musical telephone on the Corinthian Hall stage by every person in the hall." Now, we saw the interior of Corinthian Hall, and it's pretty large. And there is a distinction here, if you notice, between the speaking telephone, which requires these bell handles or earpieces to be held to your ear, and the musical telephone, which is something which is loud speaking so that you can actually hear it in the hall. And according to the paper, and we all believe what we read in the paper, every person in the hall could hear that. The cornet playing of Mr. Plogstead sounded still clearer. Each production was applauded, as the performers in Buffalo were not able to hear the plaudits. Mr. Johnson called out to his assistant there to play some other selection. Through the speaking telephone, all the directions were given and received between the two points 70 miles apart with perfect facility. As wonderful as these achievements are, they were eclipsed in the minds of many by those of the phonograph. Mr. Johnson spoke into the mouthpiece at different times such bits of language. Each of these was plainly reproduced from the indented tinfoil. The experiment of singing and playing into the mouthpiece was tried, Mr. Bottom lending his voice, Mr. Crowley employing the cornet. The following day, the process was reversed. The entertainers in Rochester delighted an audience in Buffalo. Anyone who had missed the fun in March could have chosen from Mr. Vail's full day of phonograph demonstrations in May. As the Rochester Evening Express reported on May 21st, 1878, Mr. Vail bottled up songs, recitations, barkings of dogs, yowlings of cats, and numberless other sounds which were all reproduced by the little machine before him. This instrument is certainly the crowning invention of the age. It is interesting to contemplate whether a Rochester man, 20 years of age, just beginning his career as a job printer, having started out as a bill collector, might have attended one of the phonograph shows. This man would eventually have a significant impact on the history of recorded sound, and after his death, suffer a fate rather like that of a communist politician, to be denounced and reviled, and finally rehabilitated. In 1858, Frank M. Seaman had been born in the Rochester suburb of Pittsford, which is presently my own mailing address. In the 1880 census, he was listed with his wife Lily in a boarding house on Chestnut Street in Rochester. From printing, he entered advertising, opening an agency in New York City around 1890. Where, beginning in 1896, he collaborated with Emil Berliner on the marketing and distribution of the nascent gramophone. Their association would end in a disastrous business reversal for Mr. Berliner, which nearly took down Berliner's close associate, Eldridge Johnson. It was the conflict between Berliner and Seaman that would tar the advertising man with the scoundrel brush. In this context, I first heard of Frank Seaman. After I started collecting phonographs in 1870,
you look pretty good today.
I've had some work done. I've had some work done. Joan Rivers has got nothing on me. In 1970, I quickly obtained a used copy of a book written 11 years earlier, considered to be at the time the Bible of the hobby, from Tinfoil to Stereo by Oliver Reed and Walter L. Welch. As I eagerly began to pore over its pages, I had no idea that I was digesting a revisionist, authoritarian account of recorded sound. However, I soon began to get that notion. Perhaps it was my own iconoclastic streak, a mile wide, that led me to the conclusion that something was wrong. Here was a book that glorified Edison and, to a lesser extent, Eldridge Johnson, but referred to Columbia Phonograph Company and also this fellow named Frank Seaman in the basest of terms. Columbia and Seaman were painted as scallywags, sharks, and charlatans, yet to me it didn't ring true. I didn't know Frank Seaman's Rochester connection at the time, but I sometimes reflect that he was reaching out to me from beyond. Brother from my hometown, erase the lies about me. Eventually, I met a like-minded fellow, George Paul, and we authored a series of books in which we attempted to set the record straight about the whipping boys of Reed and Welch. Hopefully people now understand that Frank Seaman was merely an accomplished businessman who was frustrated by the lethargy and collusion within the Berliner Gramophone Company, and not a kind of John Wilkes Booth determined to spill the blood of Emil Berliner and Eldridge Johnson. Frank Seaman maintained an office in Rochester at the beginning of the 20th century, handled the advertising for Kodak, and palled around with George Eastman. In this photo, Mr. Eastman is seated in the back seat next to the lady, and Frank Seaman handles the controls of the motor car. George Eastman's letters give us a perspective on Frank Seaman's world. On June 4th, 1900, in the midst of the turmoil with Berliner, about which Eastman was no doubt unaware, the Kodak founder wrote to Seaman, "Passing through one of the towns on the Santa Fe, I saw a sign, Gramophone Saloon. Have you these branches established in all principal Western cities? If so, why did you not give a fellow a card of introduction?" On November 19th, 1900, Eastman wrote to Seaman, "Hope you found the gramophone business had boomed during your absence. The Kodak business had slumped. I'm here all alone battling with adversity. Oy, if he only knew. He should stay dead." On December 24th, we thought of you many times, especially playing the gramophone, which we kept going pretty constantly. There is one thing, however, that Overman agreed upon, and that is, unless you make a funnel-shaped orifice in the sound box to put the needle in, we will not buy another gramophone. The Mackey Music Company, where J.S. Vale held his 1878 phonograph demonstration, went on to become a dealer in Edison and Columbia phonographs and graphophones and records. Beginning in the late 1890s, Mackey asserted its distinctiveness, like some other dealers of the period, by affixing its own labels to boxes containing Edison or Columbia cylinder records. But the firm went over the top when it created this bizarre fellow that you see here, a specially modified Edison home phonograph. This circa 1899 instrument was tarted up with scads of otherwise functionless bling just to enhance its visual impact, no doubt bowing to the whim of a client who didn't fancy the original practical look of the cabinet. The Mackey Music Company, founded in 1840, was Rochester's premier store of the 19th century. It incubated what would become Rochester's best-known music business of the 20th century, the Levis Music Store. Samuel W. Levis worked for Mackey for 30 years, commencing in the early 1870s. It's a safe bet that he was present at one of Vale's exhibitions in 1878. In 1903, Mr. Levis struck out on his own, opening a piano store on West Main Street in Rochester. Soon, Edison and Victor talking machines were added to his inventory. In 1905, the business moved to South Avenue, adding all types of musical instruments to the mix. Eventually, Samuel's son William and daughter Ruth took over the business, opening a second store on East Main Street in 1921. Other talking machine lines were taken on: Brunswick, Columbia, and Vocalion. Levis dominated the music business in Rochester for the better part of the 20th century. In 1960, Grinnell Brothers of Detroit acquired the Levis business. Grinnell, a well-known piano maker, was on a drive to create an empire of music stores in the Midwest and East. But the firm didn't anticipate the Detroit riots of 1967 or subsequent labor disputes that set it tottering. Overextended, Grinnell began to retrench, terminating the Levis brand around 1970. Another notable Rochester Dealer was the talking machine company of 97 Main Street. When the firm began, at the turn of the 20th century, Main Street Bridge spanning the Genesee River was lined on both sides with shops. Yes, exactly like the Ponte Vecchio in Florence, only cooler. Listen up, yo, that's what I'm talking about. That ain't Florence, that's Rochester, yeah. That's what I'm talking about. On the south side of the bridge was the Talking Machine Company. Local enthusiast Alan Mueller, who I am grateful for his research, recalls visiting the store as a child and being astonished to see the river looming outside the back door. The firm sold Edison and Victor machines and even distributed films and coin-operated amusement devices in the early days. In the mid-1960s, the knuckle-headed urban renewal that had been progressively ruining Rochester claimed the buildings on Main Street Bridge, by which time the Talking Machine Company was gone. The perfect phonographic embodiment of Western New York is the Kurtzman. That is the machines shown here. Named the Studio, it was the company's least expensive model, but to collectors, the most fascinating, not the least of which because its glass sides and glass turntable allow the inner workings to be plainly observed. Kurtzman had been a Buffalo piano maker since 1848. After the First World War, the firm briefly added talking machines to its roster. The Rochester Phono Motor Company supplied the electric drive mechanisms for the instruments, such as you see here, thereby melding the ingenuity and enterprise of the neighboring cities. Welcome to Rochester, my friends. Stop and smell the graphite grease and listen for the echoes of the voices, Johnson, Vale, Seaman, Levis, in the rushing waters of the Genesee.